It is currently 6:14. I hope this doesn't come as a severe shock to you, but it's not raining. And along those lines, I'll bet car washes are going to be busy because I have seen more, including my own, filthy vehicles because it's been raining so much and no chance to clean them up. Highs of 74 today. Right now it's 67, so it's nice. Tomorrow, highs of only 70, nothing but sunshine through the weekend. 74 for a high on Saturday, 78 on Sunday, then up to 82 on Monday. But get ready. Get ready. Next Thursday, 1 week from Thanksgiving, because today is 2 weeks from Thanksgiving. Lows in the 40s, highs in the 60s. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord. Finally, some cool weather. Not the case for our friend Andy Smith in New Hampshire, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. How you doing, Andy?
Very good, thank you. And as you mentioned, fall's kind of come around here. We were in the 20s last night, but so that's not too bad this time of year, though.
Not at all. And I hope you're talking about the temperature, not your dating history.
Oh, no, there's other people we may be able to discuss about that.
Well, that's true, yes, but not – yeah, yes, exactly right. So let me tell you, yesterday I was getting around about Elon Musk and who's the other guy, Vivek Ramaswamy, two people mm-hmm. being named in charge of the Department of Efficiency, and I just cracked a joke about, you know, two people – that it would seem like some right out of Atlas Shrugged. Why would you have two people in the Department of Efficiency? Seems redundant. And man, I got spanked on a text line. People didn't find that funny at all, although it was just, you know, you take cracks at the administration, both administrations, right? So the country, even though Trump won with a mandate, both popular vote and electoral college landslide, people are still not too much in a mood to joke, are they?
Yeah, that's unfortunate, because if you can't joke about politics, my goodness, what can you joke about?
That's the point I was trying to make. That's the only point I was trying to make.
It's shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about, I don't know where you want to start. We haven't spoken since the election, now that some time has passed. You know, I was asking you all along, was there anything that was going to be maybe beneath the polls in terms of landslide, or that where a landslide could happen one way or the other? Do you know what turned what was supposedly a neck-and-neck close race into a win of the popular vote? I think it was 75 to 71 million by Trump or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the Electoral College total that he racked up, over 300.
Well, I'd say, first of all, it really was a very close election. The national polls were showing that they were within a percentage point of each other. Battleground state polls were showing a percentage point of each other. And I think what we saw is not really a landslide so much as just a small shift from 2020, and not too different than 2016. And that the thing about elections is that you only have to win by one. 50% plus one, you win, and you get the seat. So I think this was not so much different as one would expect. Polling, again, the polls, I think, were quite good, except that they tended to underestimate Trump's support again, including our own polls. And that I think, is something the pollsters are really going to have to continue to look at.
Let me jump in for 1 second. Andy, could that be because people were hesitant to express to anybody that they really favored President Trump and just didn't want to say it?
There's some evidence of that. There's something called the spiral of silence theory that really kind of points to those sorts of things. People are unwilling to express their support for somebody if they believe that candidate is unpopular. Mm-hmm. But I think there's even more than that. You know, Trump was going around for years talking about fake news and fake polls, and you get a lot of people that just didn't want to participate in that sort of thing, a lot of Republicans. So I think that, but overall, it was a close election, as predicted.
Where do we go from here? Let's talk about the step. Well, first off, let me go back to Senate and House. Any surprises mm-hmm. there?
Not really. Again, because it was a very close election, some of those races that looked close just tilted Republican. But I think everybody expected the Senate to be about where it is. Maybe Republicans gained one more seat than was anticipated with Pennsylvania. The House, holding on to the House seats there, very close, a lot of close races with that. Maybe a little unanticipated, but still quite close. So I think overall the election was a repeat of the last two presidential elections we've had, with just, you know, essentially buzzer beaters each time.
So when it comes to the Republicans now, and we're going to have to take a break here, we'll pick it up when we come back. When it comes to the Republicans having the White House, the Senate, and the House, it's kind of like, in some ways, I don't care whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration that has all three, it's kind of like a dog chasing a car. You got it. Now what are you going to do with it? Right? So we'll pick it up there when we come back. We're talking to Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Part of that includes, I think, Tommy Tuberville telling Republicans they better get online with Trump's cabinet confirmation. They better get in line and just rubber stamp everything, put it through. Some other senators saying, not so fast, my friend. We'll pick it up there when we come back with Andy Smith, 620 Traffic Now, WWL. 6:24 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Andy, let's talk about, you got it. You know, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. You got the House, you got the Senate, you got the White House. Governing is different than campaigning. What do you do with it now?
Well, H.L. Mencken, who I love to quote, once said, democracy is the art of running the circus from the monkey cage. Well, we got the monkey cage and we got the circus. And I think it's going to be a difficult time running all those things. You know, our government's designed to be slow and inefficient and to compete against one another in the branches of government. So I think you're going to see a lot of Trump's appointees not make it through confirmation because the Senate has their own ideas about how things should be run. The House is a little bit different. That's more responsive to the public. So they will likely be going along with a lot of Trump's ideas. But there's a very small Republican majority there. So we can see a repeat of some of the things that happened over the last couple of years with rebellious Republicans in the House. So I'm thinking that this is going to be a quite an interesting 6 months here as Trump gets his government underway.
Where does the MAGA movement go from here? Because I think my own personal opinion is that this is all about Trump. And I don't know that there is an heir apparent to Trump. Or does this supersede him? Does it follow him along? Because he can't run for office again, not constitutionally. Explain that, if you will, for people that think he can, please, because I know there are some out there that think he can.
Well, there's an amendment to the Constitution that says you can serve two terms, and that's it. So he's not going to be able to run again unless he can put through a constitutional amendment or somehow convince people that the Constitution doesn't matter anymore. But he won't be running again. But to your point about there not being an heir apparent, I think that's absolutely the case. But there are a whole lot of people in Washington that think there are. And those are the people that are going to be entertaining to watch, because you're going to see the little food fights going on and being amped up as those people look to gain more power and try to take over. This real shift in the Republican Party, and this is where I think this is real, that the Republican Party has for the last 30, 40 years, really, you could start with Reagan, has becoming more and more the blue-collar party of the country, not the elite party. That's definitely the Democratic Party now. And there's going that political force is going to be there. Who's going to be the person who can step up and lead that is the next question.
And I guess the question is about the future of the Republican Party. Is it more of a Reagan? Does it go back to being, because, you know, everything, as you once said a long time ago, it's a pendulum in politics in a country. If it swings one way, then swings the other. But from the Republicans only, is the future of the Republican Party from now on MAGA and what Trump has morphed it into, or does it ever go back to like a Reagan-esque kind of Republican Party? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's going to go back to be quite a Reagan-esque party, because that was quite a unique combination of different forces, different political forces. But I don't think it's going to continue to be a MAGA party, because frankly, I think after looking at the appointments that are being made or the prospective appointments being made, it's kind of like the MAGA movement has jumped the shark. We've got so many people here that have been nominated to large federal agencies, very important agencies, both in the U.S. and worldwide, who don't have any management experience. And I think that we're just going to see the monkey cage running the circus, so to speak, again. And it's just going to be, I think it's going to be a, once Trump's gone, I don't think that MAGA really can exist.
What do you see happening with the, and I know you touched on this before, but before we let you go, with the cabinet confirmation hearings?
I think that overall that Donald Trump's decided to get rid of PBS and replace it with Fox News. The people that we've got are certainly celebrities and loyalists of his, but they're not really people who have much experience running big, big government bureaucracies.
Thank you, Andy. I appreciate your time. I really do. Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, always there when we need him. We'll take a break. We come back, and he'll be here, I guarantee you. God, good Lord willing, both of us will be here in 2028. Andy, come back for a second real quick. The 2028 sure. campaign has begun already, has it not?
Watch what Gavin Newsom is doing right now.
All right.
It's back up and running already.
There you go. Thank you, Andy Smith. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. It's hard to tell from the weather, but Thanksgiving only 2 weeks away. We'll talk about keeping it all a Louisiana Thanksgiving when we come back. Then we're going to talk about some of the challenges that the Louisiana Motor Transport Association is facing with truck drivers. And we'll talk to Will Green, President and CEO of LaBe, about Louisiana's business in a special session. A lot coming up. Stay with us right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 6:44, 16 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined now by our friend Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Mike Strain?
Man, I am doing great. I'm getting ready for a trip to England. I'm going on behalf of the British government. There will be several ag commissioners and others. We're going over there on, you know, at the invitation and paid for by the British government and the British embassy. So I'll be leaving tomorrow, be gone a week. And so we're excited about that. And this is a preliminary trade mission, and it's about looking at shared challenges and opportunities and promoting intergovernmental cooperation in agriculture. So we're excited about it. And, of course, right now we've got the legislature going on and everything going on in Washington. So it's a busy time.
You might want to get something to eat here, Mike, before you leave, because I don't know that people go to England
well,
to get fat.
I've been doing that. Yes, I understand. Yes. So we'll see how the British eat, but I know, you know, that it's not as good as us. So we got to make sure we'll bring, you know, over some, maybe some Tabasco and some, you know, some Uncle Larry's and some other good things over there. So we'll bring them some spices.
Yeah, you know, it confused me, and I've been to Ireland and Northern Ireland, is that it's like they look at you crazy if you ask for ice and a soft drink and a Coke or something. It's like, can I have some
ice?
Oh,
my gosh, yeah, you ask for ice, they did, yes. So what do you mean ice? So we're very spoiled here as far as, you know, what we have, and because, you know, ice takes electricity. And things. And so around the world, you know, the things that we really take for granted every day are just not common or available across the world.
Tell me about making Thanksgiving all Louisiana. What can people do to make sure that they have nothing but Louisiana represented on their Thanksgiving table?
Well, you can start off with some of our good sweet potatoes, you know, the Avoyelles, the Jolies, or, you know, some of the Beauregards or Evangelists. You get those Louisiana sweet potatoes, that's a must. You've got to have some Louisiana pecans, such as your Vacheron or your Little Eva or your Cane River. And you've got to have some steamed cane syrup or some local cane syrup. You make your casseroles. And don't forget, you know, at Strain Household, you know, we're going to have some catfish. We're also going to have some gumbo, a good seafood gumbo. And you've got to have, you know, some crabs in there. You've got to have some oysters. And you've got to, you know, have some shrimp or maybe some crawfish or a little crawfish etouffee or shrimp etouffee. And when you cook that, and of course, Louisiana rice with everything that you do. And so, when you select all these things, make it fresh, local, and certified Louisiana. And you talk about incredible. You can get some, you know, some corn on the cob, some local products. Go buy your farmers markets and on the local section of your grocery store when you start shopping for Thanksgiving, because it's going to be really, really, it's going to be great this year. I can't wait. I'll be getting home, you know, from Britain. And, of course, you know, it's time to sit down with family and friends and just truly celebrate. Think about that pecan pie. Oh, my goodness. I cannot wait.
Tell me, Mike, if you will, about food safety when it comes to turkey, because every year, boy, first, I guess we should start with frying turkeys, because people sometimes burn their house down, and that's never a good thing.
Yes, they do. When you're frying those turkeys, look, do it, whatever you do, don't do it where, you know, in the garage or in on the porch, make sure you are outside. You're not under an overhang. Be very, very, very careful because, again, you maybe want to do a test run. You know, follow the directions. Don't overfill with the oil because what happens, this thing gets so hot and it'll boil over and you can get a massive flame. But every year there's major fires from those turkeys. Follow the directions. You know, look at the time charts. Follow that, but be extremely careful. And look, when you pull that turkey out, look, it's hot. Be very careful. You know, you don't burn yourselves and protect, you know, from, especially if you got little children around where you're doing that. Also, when you, again, with your big turkey, remember, it takes about 4 or 5 days to thaw out a big turkey if you thaw it out in the refrigerator. You know, so follow the directions when you thaw that turkey and cook it properly. You know, I love those that, you know, have that little button in there. You see it pop out. But, again, you have to follow that. And what a lot of people do, they forget, oh, my goodness, tomorrow's Thanksgiving. I got to pull this thing out. And if you do, when you thaw it, there is a methodology to thaw, you know, in the sink. But you got to change that water every 30 minutes. Food safety. And then when you thaw it in the sink, you've got to clean that up extremely well. Hot, soapy water. You can use also, there are a number of different types of disinfectants. Wherever uncooked poultry is, you cannot put that cooked poultry back because we have to be, you know, safe as well. And then, you know, when you eat, after you eat, you know, whatever that turkey is, you should go ahead and cut that turkey up. And then if you're going to, you know, store it, but don't leave things out. It's probably going to be, it's going to be warm, maybe a little cooler than it is right now, but it's still going to be warm. So hot things hot. Cold things cold. Cook everything to the proper temperature. Follow the directions and be safe with leftovers and safe when you cook. And we'll have a great holiday season.
How's the sugarcane harvest looking, Mike?
Man, it's looking good. I tell you, we have been so blessed. Those, you know, we've had a little bit of rain, which is good. Kind of knocked that dust down. But they are rolling through, and the cane yield is good. The sugar yield is good. We're expecting one of the best years ever. We expect sugarcane now to net about $1.5 billion. That's with a B. And so we're very happy. You know, we were concerned at first. You know, Francine came in and kind of knocked some of that cane down. But it has recovered, and overall we're having an excellent cane season. We're also looking forward now as we're, you know, getting that second crop of rice, the ratoon crop cut, and all the fields flooded. We're getting ready for what's next? Crawfish season. And so the reports are good. Everybody that can is trying to make sure they've got some crawfish in those fields. We'll not be back to pre-drought conditions, but we're going to be doing a lot better this year than last year. And so with the good conditions and the good weather we're having and the slow breakdown of the rice, you know, after we cut the rice and we let those plants break down in the field in the water that feeds the crawfish, we're expecting a good crawfish season. And, of course, we can't wait. And right now is a great time to buy some shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
Shrimp are very affordable. They're very plentiful and very delicious. So start buying some shrimp as we're going into crawfish season. And look, we just can't wait.
Let me take a break. Dr. Mike Strain, our guest, a very skilled and loved, beloved veterinarian, joining us as he does every Thursday morning. Real quick, how's Hootie, the newest member of the Strain household?
Oh, man, Hootie's having a hooterific day every day. Hootie goes to work every day with Susan at the clinic, the official greeter at the clinic. But Hootie is having just a marvelous time, as you would expect. Right?
Yeah, we
for
should
a young
all,
basset hound.
We should all have Hootie's life. Hootie is the new basset hound.
Oh, my goodness.
The Strain household.
Yeah.
6:52, 8 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Agricultural Commissioner Mike Strain headed over to the UK, to England, to talk with their farmers, and it's all being paid for by the British government. Mike, what are you going to be doing? Like touring, I don't know, what do they grow in Britain? I never thought about that.
Well, they have a lot of livestock, and they have a lot of specialty crops. That's what we're going to see. We're going to see, you know, what they have and how they do it, talk about whatever challenges there are between getting products to and from England. And so what's very important, we'll be meeting with members of Parliament. We will be meeting with high-ranking agricultural officials. We'll be meeting with their federal, in other words, the person that's head of their veterinary division. And so this is a go and look and see what they have. And then we start negotiating and talking about trade and how we can work together in trade. So we're excited about that. A lot of things going on in there.
Let me talk about the Farm Bill real quick. What's going on with that?
Well, it's static. Nothing's happening with it. And we're really pushing. Said, look, y'all are back there. We need to get it done. I'm afraid that they're just probably going to do an extension until we move it into the first of next year, and then we'll start over again. And so it would start a new farm bill, because that will be a totally new Congress. And if I said, all right, if y'all do, then we're going to make some improvements to this farm bill and get these reference prices correct, and you know, and do it right. But we've got to get it done. They just can't keep kicking the can down the road. A number of things stop. And in other words, I work in conservation. I work in the Farm Services Agency. New contracts aren't getting signed. People aren't getting hired. And look, this is the roadmap for conservation and the largest industry in America, and they need to get it done.
Thank you, Mike. Safe travels. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It is currently 7:15, and guess what? It's not raining. Be a good day to get your car washed, because if yours, like mine, is just completely and totally filthy after all the rain, you got a dry stretch ahead. Looking ahead to the weather today, I can tell you it's going to be a high of 73 today, 70 tomorrow, 74 on Saturday, 78 Sunday, warming Monday into next week. Maybe a chance for showers on Tuesday. That's with that little disturbed area of weather down there. But that's going to, the high pressure system, the cold front's going to send it in the direction of Florida. And by next Thursday, 1 week from today, 1 week from Thanksgiving, highs of 64 and lows in the 40s. So how about that? It is time to talk to Renee Amar, Executive Director of Louisiana Motor Transport Association. Good morning, Renee. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm wonderful. I'm looking very forward to next Thursday's weather.
Amen. We're in a week 11 of the NFL season. I forgot what week it is of college football. That season's almost over. High school football going into the playoffs. And you lose track of the time, Renee, because it's so warm, you tend to think that it's still summertime. And all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, it's the holidays, right?
Yeah, I always thought it was interesting when I would take my kids trick-or-treating, October 31st, and we would do it in shorts.
Yeah,
it just doesn't feel like Halloween, right? Yeah.
It does not. Let's talk about, and I was saying beforehand, the number one issue facing Louisiana truck drivers, if people could guess what it is, and people came in and said, texted in and said it was Democrats and illegal immigrants, and that's not the answer.
That is not even close to the answer. But I don't think it'll surprise people when they hear our number one issue is the cost of insurance. And ironically, our second top issue is lawsuit abuse. The third issue was the economy. I don't think that really surprises anyone. But the cost of insurance has been troubling truckers for probably at least a decade. But the rapid pace that it has increased over the last 4 to 5 years, it's just gotten so out of control. It's become their second highest cost, just compared to the cost of labor. And so when your insurance, there it's increasing anywhere between 40% and 50% just this year over next year. And so it's become such a high cost that these guys just can't afford to do it anymore.
Tell me what the answer is.
Well, we think that there are a myriad of things that need to be done, and we have a set of bills that we're going to propose again for next session. But we truly believe that a lot of our costs are in our medical cost. So when you get in an accident, and just like you would go to the doctor because you had a medical procedure, a surgery, or anything like that, you pay this, you get this invoice when you get back from the hospital, and it's got all these charges on it. And let's just say that hospital bill was $50,000. Ultimately, you never really end up paying that, right? You end up paying maybe $5,000 or $10,000 on that bill. Think about that fact that $50,000 bill that gets paid by our insurance companies. They don't pay the real bill; they pay the fake bill. Mm-hmm. And so, we truly believe, especially for truckers, because our insurance minimums are so high. I don't know if people understand that we have 20,000, 25,000, maybe 50 on our cars. Typically, their minimums are around $1 million, sometimes $5 million if they're carrying hazmat. And so it's part of why we're a target on the road, but it's also part of why our expenses are so high.
Say that again, Renee. That's startling.
The minimum insurance, our basic insurance, if you are what we call a dry box, so somebody that might deliver goods for Walmart, their minimum insurance is $750,000, not $75,000, $750,000. Yeah. But most of my truckers carry at least a million, and they'll have to do layers, and it's really complicated. But if you carry, you know, gas or any type of chemical on the road, that's considered hazardous materials. And those truckers are carrying $5 million. So, and that is why we are the target on the billboards.
And what does that mean, roughly out of pocket, to an owner-operator, those kind of premiums?
Well, you know, it really depends on the type of safety record they have. But what we're seeing is that you've got a trucker. I've got a trucker that moved to the state of Mississippi a couple of years ago. And so you're talking about seven or eight trucks, $50,000 a year.
Wow.
And so I want you to think about $50,000 increasing by 50% next year. So then his premiums became $75,000. It got to the point where he couldn't truck in the state of Louisiana anymore, and he moved. And that is happening on a weekly and monthly basis.
Let me take a break. I like the use of the word target because it's exactly what it is. And you know, you see the billboards and the commercials. If they got a truck with a name on it, call me immediately. Renee Amar, Executive Director of Louisiana Motor Transport Association. It's physics, or however you want to say it. Every action has a reaction, right? 720, traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Renee Amar, Executive Director of Louisiana Motor Transport Association. Renee, we're talking about insurance being a big problem for truck drivers. Is it forcing companies out of business? And if not, or independent operators, take me through first of all, I should say. The trucks we see on the road, do companies own them? Are the majority owned by owners, operators? Take me through that, please.
It's a good mix, Tommy. In the state of Louisiana, it is really roughly about half. So 50% might be an owner-operator that actually does work for a larger company, or you'll have larger companies that just hire on their own drivers. Sometimes you have companies that do both. They'll have owner-operators, so that person owns their own truck and, you know, more so gets to dictate their own schedule. And they'll have somebody who's actually a worker, and so they just straight up work for UPS or Walmart. So they have both. And one of the things that you mentioned was these truckers that are moving out of state. The comparison that we easily can draw is this trucker that moved to Mississippi. That same exact insurance policy, because he had it priced at 2 years ago, that was $50,000 in the state of Louisiana, ran him about $37,000 in the state of Mississippi. It would have been malpractice for his business for him not to move to the state of Mississippi. They can do that in Texas. They can do that in Arkansas, and they will see their insurance costs drastically drop. And one of the differences in Mississippi is that they have a cap on damages. And I know that that seems extreme to lawmakers in the state of Louisiana, but I just feel like we're at such a crisis point in the state with our truckers that we have got to do some pretty extreme measures.
So where does the legislature stand on this? Where does the governor stand on this? Are they hearing you?
This is part of the problem, is that we had some bills that were heard during the last regular session, and many of them got through the process. One of our major bills that dealt with these medical costs that I was talking about earlier was vetoed by the governor. And so we have got to get the governor on the side of ours to help us fix this issue. You know, we are smack dab in the middle of the insurance companies and the trial bar, and we don't have any choice. These are mandated insurance, you know, policies that we have to purchase. And so we just really need help from the lawmakers are ready. They're willing, you know, to do whatever it takes to help us lower our costs. We've got to get the governor on board.
So what happens in the near future between now and then? Who winds up paying for this?
Yeah, I mean, that is you and me. And, you know, the commercial market does operate a little differently than the auto market, just because, as I mentioned, you know, one of the things that's hard for people to understand is that we actually settle cases when we're not even at fault, mm-hmm. just because we have that fear of going before a judge or going before a jury and them tagging us with what we call a nuclear verdict. So something that probably should have been a $50,000 or $100,000 case becomes a $1 million or a $2 million case. All that money comes out of our insurance premiums. Whether people like to understand that or not, that is the reality of the situation. We pay for all the trial bar costs. We pay for all the insurance companies' costs. That's all baked into our insurance premiums.
Are you being heard? I don't know. I got to leave this, Renee, other than, you know, the problem is obvious. I don't think you need to.
Yeah.
We always talk about, and with the tax reform package that's going on, we always talk about looking to other states. Why not look to other states on this?
And they are definitely trying to do that. But just as I said, and it's why I'm here talking about it today, Tommy. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to remind people, especially the lawmakers that are looking at tax reform right now, it's hard to recruit businesses into the state of Louisiana when they start looking at their insurance costs. And so they can change the tax system all they want. If they don't tackle insurance costs, we're not going to grow this economy.
Thank you, Renee. I appreciate your time. Good luck to y'all. Renee Amar, Executive Director of Louisiana Motor Transport Association. When we come back, we're going to talk to Will Green, President and CEO of LABI, Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, about how Louisiana's businesses are feeling about the special session and what needs to change to help grow our economy. And LABI is not small business, but I did wonder, as I was taking one of my many naps yesterday, if the move toward tax reform would help or hurt small businesses at the expense of attracting or hurt small businesses with the eye of attracting big businesses. We'll talk more when we come back. 7:30, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It's not raining. Thank God for that, right? Finally get the car washed, maybe. Could be dry for a couple of days and a little bit cooler. Highs today only going to be around 70 degrees or so, maybe a little bit warmer than that, mid-70s and 78, 74 tomorrow, rather. I'll get this straight. 73 today, 70 tomorrow, 74 on Saturday, 78 Sunday. Warms a little bit by Monday, but by next Thursday, you're looking for some cool weather? Ladies, you want to wear the boots. Guys, you want to wear the sweaters. You might get your chance because Lowe's next Thursday, 1 week before Thanksgiving, of course today, 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, lows in the mid-40s, highs only in the lower 60s next Thursday and Friday, so I think we'll all be looking forward to that. Will Green joins us now, President and CEO of LABI, Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. How you doing, Will?
Tommy, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at a story here from NOLA.com, and it quotes LABI as saying, before the session started, if we want to compete with neighboring states, we must simplify and streamline Louisiana's tangled tax code while eliminating our franchise and inventory taxes and centralizing our local sales tax collection system. So with that as the background, how's it going so far with the special session?
Tommy, there's a lot of bills moving quickly. I mean, if you're a business operating in Louisiana right now, you are in a state that is one of three that has a corporate income tax, a corporate franchise tax, and an inventory tax. And so to the extent that the legislature is trying to address those inefficient, regressive taxes that, like I said, not many states have, they're doing it. They've sent a lot of those bills to repeal the corporate franchise tax, to lower corporate income, and to lower personal income, over to the Senate in just a few days. And so it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but a lot of discussions are happening. And so, you know, we're moving along.
When you say they're regressive taxes, explain, if you will, to people that don't understand what that means.
Yeah, so these are taxes that generally, if you look at any good tax policy expert, they'll tell you you need clear, transparent taxes. You need taxes that are certain and predictable. Generally, if you broaden the base, that's good tax policy. Generally speaking, if you do tax a sales tax or a service, the tax needs to be at the end user to avoid pyramiding and things like that. Because ultimately, if you pyramid taxes, meaning like if you tax a widget several times through the process before it gets to the end consumer, all that does is increase the cost to the end consumer. And so to the extent you can avoid double taxation, to the extent you can broaden the base, and to the extent taxes are clear, transparent, certain, and predictable, that's good tax policy.
So when it comes to, and this is a question I had that popped into my head yesterday, maybe you can walk me through this because I'm not a businessman, but do any of these reforms come at the expense of small business in favor of large business or not, Will?
Well, so I think, you know, we talked about lowering the corporate income tax and also lowering the personal income. And so a lot of your big businesses are C corporations. And so they pay a corporate income tax and a corporate franchise tax. The governor's package and the bills that are moving along would repeal the franchise tax and would lower the corporate income tax. And so that's a positive if you're a business taxed as a C corp. A lot of small businesses.
Wait, hang on a second. You say C corp. Yeah, okay. You know what? Let me take a break because that's exactly what I was going to ask you. The difference between a C corp and an LLC and who would be affected by this, okay? Will Green, our guest, president and CEO of LABI, Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. We've been following the special session as closely as we could because it's going to change the tax structure in Louisiana for a lot of people. Hopefully for the better, and we've been trying to follow all of it. It is extremely complicated. We'll continue this discussion when we come back. 7:51 now, 9 till 8, traffic, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, couple of minutes left with Will Green, president and CEO of LABI, Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. I'm Tommy Tucker, this is WWL, talking about the special session as it relates to tax reform. So, Will, quickly, if you can, please pick it up with LLC and C Corps and the difference, please, and who would be taxed and who wouldn't.
Yeah, sure, Tommy. Yeah, so look, I'm no accountant, and it's been years since I had my tax law class in law school. But to the extent that your big corporations, generally speaking, a lot of them they're taxed C Corps. And they're taxed at the corporate level. Again, this isn't everybody, but generally speaking, a lot of our small businesses are limited liability corporations, and they choose to be taxed at the personal level. So the income flows down through the company, and they're taxed at the personal level. And so this plan is designed to be a tax relief through the reduction in the corporate income tax, as well as a reduction in personal income tax. And so to the extent we can do that, it'll cover our small businesses, our large businesses, and businesses of all shapes and sizes. And so that's kind of what we were talking about before we went to break.
Let's talk about this inventory tax. I've talked to Mike Baham about this. He said St. Bernard Parish, spoiler alert, is going to opt out. I asked Richard Nelson if it would be, in essence, having one parish compete against another if some parishes choose to opt out when it comes to development. For the state. Talk about that, if you will, please, and LABI's view on that, on the inventory tax.
Yeah, the inventory tax is probably what I'm hearing, concerns about the inventory tax and the removal of the credit is probably what I'm hearing the most from my members right now. We're one of 9 states in the country that still fully taxes inventory. It's taxed at the local level. And years and years ago, the state came in and said, look, that we know it's a bad tax, but we know the locals rely on it. So we'll put a Band-Aid on it and we'll give you back a credit, business, from your personal and corporate income taxes. And so the governor's plan and the secretary's plan that's moving through the House right now would be to allow parishes to opt out of the inventory tax. So businesses no longer get that credit. The locals no longer charge businesses that ad valorem inventory tax. And in return for that opt-out, they'll get a one-time payment and some additional severance tax revenues. And so I know a lot of the businesses are looking at that. A lot of the parishes are looking at that, trying to figure out, is that a good move for me to remove the inventory tax? One of the concerns that we're hearing from our members is, well, if they don't opt out and they still choose to assess an inventory tax, but the credit goes away to business, then that's a net negative for business.
Thank you, Will. I appreciate your time. Complicated stuff. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Mike Pearlstein about Jeffrey Vepi. Thank God the sun is out, huh? Highs today of 73 and no rain. We can get our cars cleaned finally. Highs of 70 tomorrow after overnight lows of 55, 74 on Saturday, 78 on Sunday. Back to the 80s by Monday, but Today is 2 weeks from Thanksgiving. Next Thursday, 1 week away from Thanksgiving. Highs will only be 64 with lows in the mid-40s. So I am liking that. Mike Pearlstein, how about you? You like the colder weather?
I'll take it.
All right. Let's talk about, first of all, you know, I always got to compliment you and Katie and David Hammer over at Channel 4 and Ramon Antonio Vargas and the work that you investigative reporters do, because it's not easy. And but for that work, there are a lot of things that go on that we would never know about. So, you know, I really do appreciate the work that you guys do. Tell me what's going on first, because you got a couple of stories working here. Tell me what's going on with the infamous Officer Vapi.
Yes, well, infamous might be the right word at this point, because what we received this week were the reports of the latest internal investigations on, would normally say PIB investigations, Public Integrity Bureau, but they had to recuse themselves because they botched the first one. It got outsourced to a law firm.
Wait, let me slow you down a little bit, Mike, because I think that's important, the context of this. Let's go back.
Yeah.
No, it is, really. Don't you think? It's a long story, so go back and take
it
a
is.
Second on that, if you would.
Well, just to, you know, give the long-term picture here, it all began when Officer Vapi started working irregular hours with the person that he was supposed to be protecting, Mayor LaToya Cantrell. And that included many hours at the Pontalba apartment, where the mayor wasn't supposed to be having overnight stays in the first place, but was. And later, come to find out, going out in what appeared to be romantic, or at least, you know, social interactions between Vapi and the mayor, which is also prohibited. And what surfaced were photographs of Vapi and the mayor at a couple restaurants eating and drinking, in addition to many, many hours of security video showing, you know, Vapi and the mayor coming and going from that Pontalba apartment. Well, complaints were made, Public Integrity Bureau of the Police Department, you know, assigned to look into those and see if there were any violations. There were many, many violations. However, the PIB, Public Integrity Bureau, stopped short of a full investigation, according to the federal judge and the independent police monitors, you know, overseeing the consent decree, meant to reform the police department and make sure the police department is, you know, doing all the right things, including internal investigations. In other words, they kind of pulled their punches. They didn't obtain Vapi's cell phone, which they were entitled to when he was, you know, an officer, and other things that might have shed light on the full extent of what is the mayor and her bodyguard, police bodyguard Vapi, doing exactly. Well, the feds picked that up and decided, yes, we're getting the phone and all the other relevant evidence. So now Vapi is facing 8 felony charges in federal court for wire fraud, for payroll fraud, essentially, as well as lying to the FBI by saying that he was not having a romantic relationship. The FBI seems very certain in its indictment that they were having a romantic relationship. So and the end result of the PIB not going, you know, doing the full extent of the investigation, that became a huge issue within the consent decree of the PIB falling short, huge federal court hearing on the matter, and a very scathing report by the federal judge overseeing the consent decree, Judge Susie Morgan. Because of that now conflict and stain on the PIB record, the second round of complaints against Vapi was outsourced to a law firm, Transcendent Law Group, and they took it on and they produced a report that in many ways you know, covered some of the ground we already know with a lot more detail. In fact, very damaging information about how Vapi did or did not do his job, supposedly protecting the mayor.
Okay.
And just to give you some examples of where he fell short, the report found that, for example, April 7th of 2023, when, you know, Vapi was supposed to be protecting the mayor, they were eating and drinking on that balcony of the Tableau restaurant in the French Quarter, drinking mimosas, drinking a bottle of Pinot Noir wine over the course of 3+ hours. And the violations there begin with Officer Vappi wearing a gun while drinking on the job. Just drinking alcohol, period, is another violation. Clearly not protecting the mayor with his back to the door. And at one point, because there's, you know, video footage, you know, some kind of security camera video at the restaurant, getting up and leaving the mayor by herself, which is his, you know, main mission as a protective, on the protective detail. So it just kind of laid out what, you know, expands what we already know, that a lot of things went very, very wrong.
Do you know if or how that factors into this whole promotion mess that's going on over there?
Well, you know, the promotion mess is a separate little dumpster fire.
Yeah, there you go. I like dumpster fire. Department. I like dumpster fire better than mess, Mike. I think dumpster fire describes it better.
Well, these things just tend to pop up with the police department, and let's give the police department credit. They are now on the verge of hitting that 2-year, you know, sustainment period, the off ramp of this 12-year consent decree for doing almost everything right or required by the federal government to improve a lot of deficient areas. But these little controversies still emerge. And now we have an investigation, an actual investigation into these. It's a promotion list that was through testing of candidates who wanted to become majors and captains, and the list came out, and some people at the top of the list were on the verge of getting promoted when the mayor and the administration decided to put a halt to it, claiming that there was some kind of irregularity in the testing process. And now that whole testing process, everything has been halted, the promotions aren't happening, the testing process is being reviewed, and there's an investigation into just exactly what happened. So not a great look as you're going through the very last of the public hearings to finally get the federal judge's stamp of approval to get out of this consent decree.
Let me take a quick break, Mike. When we come back, I want to move on, if we can, to the other story about this shoplifting thing that is just, I was slack-jawed yesterday watching this. Mike Pearlstein, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter. You're not going to believe what he's got for us next. 822 Traffic Now, WWL. Quickly back to Mike Pearlstein, WWL TV investigative reporter. We're on now to another story that he's covering, is in the process of covering, I guess, about, Mike, the floor is yours. I don't even know where to start with this one.
Well, Tommy, one of the, I guess you could call it, rewards of what I do as an investigative reporter is we get this front row seat to things that you just couldn't possibly make up in your wildest imagination, and this story falls in that category. To summarize, there was a woman in Hammond. Her name is Carolyn Harrell, and she ran for the Hammond City Council on basically a law enforcement platform. She was a professor of criminal justice at the North Shore Community Technical College. Her husband is a career police officer. She got the strong backing of the mayor and the appointed police chief. And she ran a really strong race, raised a lot of money, almost unseated an incumbent, and went on to continue, you know, teaching criminal justice, only to have information surface that she was not just a shoplifter, but an impulsive skip-scan shoplifter. And what that means is, of course, in this day and age, we've all confronted the self-checkout lines where you scan your own items. And she was making a habit of routinely doing with this very modern-day crime of scanning some of her items and taking some items and just sticking them right in her bag and not paying for it. Okay, it's one thing to have a you know, take a candy bar, or maybe somebody's really in need and take some necessity. We've all heard about, you know, shoplifting diapers when you need that and don't have money. She did this not once, not twice, but 21 different times in which she was caught. These are just the instances in which she was caught at a couple different Target stores, one in Covington, one in Hammond. And, of course, the other element of this very modern-day crime, which is rampant all over the country, everyone has seen the self-checkout counters now at big-box stores. They have really extensive security and cameras and loss prevention officers who are chronicling basically her every move. Mm. So when I got my hands on the full police report, there's the list of all of these items and thefts, sometimes two shoplifting incidents on the same day. So clearly there was a problem. She did ultimately get charged and pled guilty to theft. Now, what was an interesting twist in the whole thing is, of the 21 incidents, they tallied up losses of $1,400, which would make this a felony. Anything that's over $1,000 is a felony charge. And because of her apparent connections with mayor and police chief, and she had a school board member who was an attorney represent her, and just a lot of steps along the way, she was given some extreme leniency. They took, of the 21 counts, they took 7 to go to court, and it put her dollar amount under $1,000 and made it a misdemeanor. So she pled to, I think it was ultimately 8 counts that she pled to.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the time and the effort as always. And that's going to screw up checkout for everybody eventually. 8:31, time for traffic and news and everything else. Dave Cohen out, WWL. 8:46, 14 till 9. J.P. Morrell joins us right now, New Orleans City Council member at large. Right, J.P.?
Yep, I'm here.
Yeah, all right. No, but I meant at large. I got that right, correct?
You did get it right this time, Tommy.
Yeah,
you get it right about half the time.
Well, you know, I'm 50-50. Look, you bat 50-50 in the majors. Ted Williams. People are asking, who's Ted Williams, right?
Well, I mean, it's better than the Saints and the better than science for sure. So,
hey,
let's
talk about scrim. I know this is it seems like a minor thing, but for people that don't know, scrim is a story unto itself that is a dog that is just bigger than the dog could ever be. You had scrim at the city council the other day, did you? Tell me the story of scrim real quick, because it is a good story about community coming together. Tell me about it.
Well, basically, you had a dog that was adopted in River Parishes, brought to New Orleans. His name was Scrim. He escaped from the family soon afterward, and for about 177 days, he was roaming across the city, pretty much from City Park through Gertown. And the people at Zeus's Rescue got involved. They found out the story about him. They tried to get to him, and basically, they were in a race against time to kind of rescue Scrim from inevitably being run over by a car or somehow malnourished or lost the streets of New Orleans. And it really was a powerful story when we celebrated the council, because you had pretty much the entirety of Mid-City working with this rescue team. And they had gas-powered net guns like Spider-Man and trank darts and everything. And they spent 177 days working with the community, getting sightings, getting everything to get it done. And it was truly impressive.
Scrim's story turned into a national story from the Associated Press. That's how big it was. And Scrim is fine now, right?
Scrim is fine. He actually got adopted by one of the two people who co-founded Zeus and started the rescue. And we celebrated him at the council, gave him some treats and a collar, and really just it was a really great story, Tommy, because it was an entire community coming together. I mean, they were talking about how they were getting sighting calls at 2 and 3 a.m. in the morning about where he was. And the crazy thing is, when they found him, Tommy, he was malnourished. He had fleas and ticks, obviously. He also had half his ear missing, and two bullets were found in him.
If it happens again, any thought of putting Scrim on an ankle monitor?
Well, Scrim now has a satellite monitor on his collar.
Good.
So this will no longer be he will not be like the juveniles that we had at juvenile district court. They know where he is to within feet.
Will Matt Dennis be monitoring scrim or not? Will it be ASAP or somebody else? I'm just curious.
Neither. Hopefully it's not Elon Musk, but we'll see.
Oh my. Let's talk about this sinkhole that's gone on. Tell me what's happening with this thing. And this came up at a budget hearing, right?
Yeah, so I was at a budget hearing, the first budget hearing, the AB budget hearing at Warren Easton. A gentleman approached me and said, hey, he recognized me from where I used to walk my, I used to push my son in a stroller across the Fillmore Bridge by the Wisner bike path. He said, have you been by there recently? I said, no. And he goes, well, there's a really large sinkhole that needs to be addressed. He kind of gave me where it was. I biked over there the weekend afterwards, and he was really underselling it. It's a hole. It's about three feet wide, about 3-4 feet deep. And once you walk off the bridge, continuing on the sidewalk, it's like kind of covered by like roots and leaves, like an Indiana Jones, like Temple of Doom trap. But if you step in there, you're done. I mean, your leg is broken, your bike is mangled, you're just ruined. And so I went there, looked at it, I was biking with my family, kind of looked at it, and it's going to require some long-term and short-term solutions. But it was more, I highlighted it on my socials because people tend to come to the budget meetings just to complain about the budget and highlight budget priorities. But it's also helpful to kind of give council members heads up on things that are plaguing you and bothering you. And that was an instance in which I've already contacted DPW, and we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with it. I mean, in the short term, I think it's going to have to be filled with a temporary solution, whether it's shells or something else. But it's really going to require probably cement and a really long-term, more robust solution that'll probably take place over the next year.
And to be clear, this is something that people could have stepped right into, and I mean not into, literally into, and almost disappeared into, right? Right off the sidewalk of the bridge?
Absolutely. When you're going west on Fillmore, across the bridge, going towards the driving range, literally if you look down, stepping off the bridge, there is a gaping hole. Now, like I said, if you glance at it passing by, you may not see it because there's enough like roots and debris and vines that have kind of covered it that it's kind of half concealed. But when you move them left and right, it is a gaping hole. Like, it's not a twist your ankle. It's a you're running suddenly and one of your legs drops down and you're basically a thoroughbred with a broken leg. Or, I mean, an entire bike wheel could certainly fall in there and just be mangled. I mean, it's pretty bad. And more importantly, because of the way Fillmore is constructed, there really isn't a way for bikes or pedestrians to be in the street. So bikers typically use the sidewalk to cross the bridge because it's hard to share it with cars. It's just very dangerous, and it's a priority getting it fixed.
Real quick, we got to take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I'm just curious about the depth of this thing. Is it like 5 feet deep? How deep is it?
No, it's about 3 feet.
That's enough. I mean,
it's enough for if you're jogging and you have your headphones on, you're not paying attention, you step off that bridge, and like I said, literally, you'll drop your whole leg in there.
Next thing, you know, they got there and they got the tent up, and who knows what happens. All right, let's take a break. 8:53, we'll talk about politics and mayoral race and budget hearings and more when we come back. Always good to talk to J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member. Man, a man, him and Walt LeJay, a long time ago, and I was impressed by both of them. 8:53, 7 till 9, rather, traffic, WWL. 60 seconds left with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans Council Member at Large. J.P., final thoughts on the budget process and the upcoming mayoral race.
Well, I mean, as far as the budget process, we are finalizing everything. We had our community meetings, had tremendous feedback, and have made adjustments accordingly. As far as the mayor's race, I mean, it's shaping up to be interesting.
Do you? I'm trying to remember now. You are not term limited when it comes at large, are you?
I am not term limited. I am running for re-election. I am not running for mayor, but like many people, I am very interested to see who the people who are running for mayor.
What would be at the top of the list when it comes to qualifications for your choice for mayor?
Someone who has experience in city government and someone who understands the importance and the urgency of solving the problems that have been left over by this administration.
Thank you, JP. Appreciate your time as always. Have a good weekend. JP Morrell, New Orleans City Council member. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk football, man. We're going to talk to Zach Nagy, publisher of LSU Tigers on Sports Illustrated, about what Brian Kelly said this week and about LSU, what they need to fix before the Florida game, how the rest of the season could shake out for the Tigers. Also, about the future when it comes to transfer portal and more. Then we'll talk to the Cajun Cannon, get his take. A lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Cold front bait. Yeah, me too. I'm on Team Cold Front as well. All right, thank you. Speaking of which, is it going to be Tiger bait or Gator bait? That's the question this weekend. Zach Nagy joins us now, publisher of LSU Tigers on Sports Illustrated. How you doing, Zach?
Doing good on this end. Trying to obviously recover after a brutal loss last weekend.
Yeah.
Shift focus to Florida week, but doing good on this end. How about yourself?
I'm all right. I don't know if you heard me. You probably didn't, but I was saying at one point they had a shot of Jalen Milroe running down the numbers at Tiger Stadium. I swear to goodness, it looked like the movie Forrest Gump. Remember that scene of Tom Hanks just galloping down the field? That's what it looked like.
I do, and he was running all over the place, man.
Yeah, it was not good. Let's talk about what Brian Kelly had to say after the game and how LSU is not eliminated from the playoffs. And you know, I don't want to do the old cliche Jim Mora playoff thing, but that's kind of the least of their problems now, I would guess.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're on the outside looking in when it comes to a playoff berth opportunity. And this team is just looking to get 1% better every single day. And we had the opportunity to talk to Brian Kelly after the game Monday and then yesterday on the SEC teleconference. And just about shifting focus, moving forward to Florida week, and trying to end the season with three wins, because you can only control what you control. The outside factors will do what they can, but there's a chance to make the SEC championship game. It's a far, far chance, but there is one nonetheless, and just got to control what they can control, win their three games, and move forward from here. The outside factors will control themselves.
And look, I'm not trying to get crazy here or anything, but it's not that beyond the realm of possibility. If LSU takes care of their business, it's not that long of a shot that they wind up in the SEC title game, right?
It's not. And that's the thing that Brian Kelly and the rest of his coaching staff continue trying to instill in the team is that, look, you're not done with it. The team isn't done. It's about keeping your head held high and finishing strong. And if you control your business and win your last three games and win out, the outside factors will do what they have to do in order to get to the SEC championship game, if that's what's on their path. So it's not that far-fetched. Obviously, a lot of outside factors do need to work in their favor. But again, like you said, not that far-fetched.
It's not like that Saturday, that magical Saturday. I know Missouri was involved, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, when LSU wound up playing for the national championship. You remember that?
I do. And you're absolutely right. It's not like this ridiculous thing that needs to happen. There's a chance. Well, we'll see. But control your business first, and we'll see what happens on the outside.
Basically, LSU does have to win out. The favorites have to win out, and Arkansas has to. Say again?
Oh, no. You're good.
Tim says, no, Tim was telling me something in my ear. Georgia has to win this weekend. The favorites have to win out. Arkansas has to upset Missouri, which is not beyond the realm of possibility, although Missouri's had a decent season, and then LSU gets to go to the title game. Let's talk about, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on last week, Zach, but, man, you know, this was not a surprise. This was not the Texas A&M quarterback. You knew what you had waiting for you in Jalen Milroe. How could they not be better prepared for this?
Yeah, Ryan Kelly, right after the game, said, it looks like we didn't even practice for 2 weeks, right? They looked unprepared. They looked like they had no game plan. Nothing was going in their favor. And, of course, we can sit here and focus on the Jalen Milroe aspect of things because he obviously played a fantastic football game, and LSU made him look like a prime Mike Vick. He looked fantastic as a dual-threat signal caller. And on the other side of the ball, Garrett Nussmeier and company offensively couldn't get anything rolling either. So it was about as unprepared of a football team as I've seen in the Brian Kelly era. They had nothing going their way. Offensively, you could not diversify the playbook in any way, shape, or form. The run game was abysmal. Garrett Nussmeier's receivers couldn't get open at all. Flip it to the other side of the football. And Jalen Milroe was fantastic. 185 rushing yards on 12 carries. He was doing every single thing he wanted. Misdirection, options, etc. He was doing all he could. LSU had no answer, and the result is what it is, unfortunately.
Garrett Nussmeier, to me, seems to be a guy that's just lost his confidence completely. How do you go about, first of all, do you agree with that or not? And secondly, how do you go about restoring that?
It's a challenging situation, of course, because he does look like he's lost his confidence, and he's not playing with that itch, that touch that he had before as well. And for him, it's just about continuing to put your head down and work. Brian Kelly on the SEC teleconference yesterday said that there's obviously no quarterback controversy in Baton Rouge.
No.
Garrett Nussmeier's the guy, and it's about continuing to work on his mechanics, work on his fundamentals, and continue to become a better quarterback. Obviously, we've seen the jump that quarterbacks have made from year one to year two in Baton Rouge. Started with Joe Burrow, and then it finished off with Jaden Daniels. Now you're looking at a guy, Garrett Nussmeier, who's only started 10 games in his career. And I know some people are going to be like, well, that's double-digit games. That's a large sample size. It is, but it isn't at the same time. When you're making your first start against Alabama in these big-time games, experience is going to be your best friend. He's continuing to gain more and more each day. His confidence will gain, but he just needs to get more experience under his belt in order to become that next great quarterback at LSU.
So when it comes to Garrett Nussmeier, I'm a football fan. I'm not a coach or anything, but it seems to me like, man, 90% of his problem is between his ears. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think when the season started, it was always going to be about his decision-making and trying to shed that gunslinger narrative that's been surrounding his name for his entire career. He loves to throw those tight window passes. He loves to see what he can get away with. And sometimes it's the thorn in his side, of course. And we've seen that over the last couple of games with, you know, near double-digit turnovers. So it's been a challenge for him. And that's where experience becomes your best friend. That's where sitting in the film room alongside quarterbacks coach and offensive coordinator Joe Sloan becomes your best friend. There are opportunities for him to get better. He needs to end the season with a bang, go into the offseason, and get to work, because he can make those NFL throws. He has a diverse skill set. It's just about continuing to, like you said, get a little bit better between the ears and make those right decisions, because the skill set's fantastic. It's the decision-making that he needs to continue to work on. I completely agree with you, Tommy.
What else did Brian Kelly have to say about the team this week? Defense, etc.
Really, it's just about continuing to put your head down. It's about continuing to work and not necessarily put that game behind you and forget about it. Remember it to a certain degree, but don't let it kind of determine how the season ends. You still have three games. You still have an opportunity to win out. And like we said a couple minutes ago, there's still a chance to make that SEC championship game, of course, but it's about getting 1% better every single day. That's Brian Kelly's kind of motto, and that's how they're going to look at it over the next 3 weeks.
Let me take a break. Well, I got time for a couple more questions. Tell me about the Florida offense. What kind of offense do they run? Do they run like two quarterbacks?
They run with DJ Lagway, and that's their mobile signal caller, who was out last week against Texas with a hamstring injury. He suffered it in week 10, and it was one where the team really thought that he was going to be out for the rest of the season. He got carted off the field, and all signs pointed towards his season being done, but initial tests came back positive on that front. He sat out last week, and now he's trending to play this weekend against LSU. And look, it's another mobile quarterback. This is a guy that is going to give LSU problems. We've seen LSU struggle against dual-threat quarterbacks. Florida quarterback DJ Lagway is just that. So, yes, he won't be 100%, but this is a guy who's a five-star recruit, cream of the crop guy, who's certainly going to give some issues when on the field. So he can make all the throws. He can get down the field with his legs as well. LSU has a challenge defensively once again. So you let DJ Lagway run all over you, it's going to be a long day in the swamp once again. But if you can contain a guy who's not necessarily 100%, gives LSU a really good chance to come out with a win.
Now we'll take a break. Picking up, we come back with Zach Nagy, publisher of LSU Tigers on Sports Illustrated. We'll look ahead to injuries. We'll talk about injuries. We'll talk about a recruiting class. I want to talk about Brian Kelly and this whole mess that's gone on with transfer portal, name, image, and likeness. I think without doubt that's what drove Nick Saban out. He'll say that he couldn't deal with the transfer portal. He got a new Republican Congress, House, Senate. Who knows what's going to happen with the House case? We spent an hour talking about that yesterday. And whether you like it or not, that is the new situation for college football. So you better adapt and deal with it. Although, I also want to talk about Clemson, because Dabo Swinney did not play transfer portal as much, and now they seem to be doing all right as well. 919, got any questions? 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker back with Zach Nagy, publisher of LSU Tigers on Sports Illustrated here on WWL. 925 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Zach Nagy, publisher of LSU Tigers on Sports Illustrated. So bottom line, before we move on from Florida, you got Billy Napier, former ULL coach, was a candidate for the LSU job. Now he's 0-2 as a head coach against LSU. I guess it was nothing against Billy, but it was a good move by LSU maybe not to get him. And thoughts about Brian Kelly's future moving forward, manipulating the transfer portal. Who knows what's going to happen with the new legislation. Thoughts on all of that, Zach?
Yeah, I think when you look at the future of Brian Kelly and Baton Rouge, it's a positive outlook. And I know a lot of people are prisoners of the moment right now, where you're coming off of a devastating loss to Alabama. You're 6-3. You're not looking at that LSU standard right now. But when you look at the future of the program, it's in good hands. You have the number one quarterback in the country, Bryce Underwood, set to put pen to paper on December 4th with LSU. Number one running back, number one cornerback. You have a top three recruiting class in America set to make their way to Baton Rouge for the 2025 season. And then 2026, you got some guys in the state that you can lock down as well. So on the recruiting front, you're looking at a really good roster construction coming in the future. And then a second ago, like you were talking about the transfer portal, you have an opportunity to go out there and kind of open up the checkbook, go get some immediate impact guys. You're going to need to go get some offensive linemen, a wide receiver, some defensive backs. There are key pieces that you need to go add to this roster in the foreseeable future to make this team competitive once again. But the outlook for Brian Kelly's tenure, it's looking positive. I know a lot of people, like I said a second ago, prisoners of the moment. It's tough looking at the team right now. But looking long-term, they have a good thing going in Baton Rouge. And I think Brian Kelly's going to get this ship steered in the right direction soon.
Speaking of which, you know, you talk about what a difference Jaden Daniels can make. Look at the difference he's making for the Commanders. What kind of difference could Bryce Underwood and first of all, let me take a step back. There's no indication that anything has changed with any of that, right?
Yeah, from everybody that I've spoken to about Bryce Underwood, I know his name's stealing headlines, and everybody's talking about Michigan and the NIL offer, et cetera, but he's fresh off a three-day stay in Baton Rouge. Fantastic official visit with him and his extended family. All signs point towards him putting pen to paper with LSU and making things official during the early signing period. But to your question, this is a guy who's a unicorn. He's a program-changing prospect, the number one player in America. He can come in and make an immediate impact. Obviously, if Garrett Nussmeier stays, he'll continue having the keys to the car in 2025. But looking at the future, Bryce Underwood with a guy who can come in and change the trajectory of the program in the blink of an eye.
He's from Michigan, and I know Tim tells me he wears a big Tiger diamond necklace. Do you know what where the connection was made with LSU? Because this guy is, you talk about a unicorn, this is a generational talent, right?
He is, and this is the recruiting efforts of offensive coordinator Joe Sloan. This is a guy who's proven to be a guy who can go out and get gem after gem in the transfer portal, recruiting realm, whatever it is. Joe Sloan's the elite level of a recruiter as they come, and he went up there and he went national to go get a quarterback from Michigan who's proven to be one of those top guys to come out of the quarterback slot in quite some time, since maybe like a Trevor Lawrence. So he's a guy who can come in and change the trajectory of a program instantaneously. Joe Sloan put on his recruiting cap and really developed a relationship with Bryce Underwood early in his recruiting process, and that relationship proved to become important down the stretch when he signed, or not signed, but committed to LSU on January 6th. And then prepares to sign later this year.
And that Jaden Daniels story kind of figures into this because he wants to be Jaden Daniels, right?
He does. He wants to be that next great quarterback at LSU. And when he was on campus on Saturday night in Death Valley, he was wearing a shirt that had him in the middle, Joe Burrow on one side, and Jaden Daniels on the other side, kind of alluding to the fact that he wants to be that next great quarterback out of LSU. And he certainly has the opportunity to if all things continue trending in the right direction. He's a guy who can come in, develop, and then become a great quarterback in Baton Rouge because he has all the intangibles to do just that.
How binding is what he signs on December 4th?
It's basically like an NIL contract at this point. The way that the new landscape is, it's unique. You're basically signing a contract, not just a name, not just a kind of a, how would you put it, just a letter of intent. Mm-hmm. Now you're signing an NIL contract, quote unquote. So it's binding. Once you put pen to paper, you are locked in with that program, and we're all waiting to see what Bryce Underwood does, but all signs point towards him doing just that.
So what time on December 4th can we all have that sigh of relief?
Hopefully early in the morning. Hopefully 7 a.m. local time is usually when you begin to put pen to paper, begin to do that. That's when they'll probably get the facts over from it, but we all know that he'll have a big signing day opportunity, a big media opportunity out in Belleville, Michigan. So we can all put a sigh of relief. Early morning, December 4th, hopefully, as all things trend in that direction.
This guy that kicks off for LSU, you know, they seem to have gotten the kicking problems. You don't realize you got a problem until you have one with the kicking game, right? Damian Ramos had been money. Seemed like they got all of that together. Alabama, was he didn't miss one against Alabama, did he? I don't think so.
No. Not to my knowledge.
But I'm just wondering about 32, guy that kicks off. Does he eventually become a field goal kicker? And if so, how good could he be?
Yeah, Aaron Burrell's a guy who's from the state of Louisiana, the number one kicker in the state, and this is a guy who continues to boom it for touchback after touchback every single opportunity. His leg is as strong as they come. He was battling an injury during the offseason, so he's not necessarily a field goal kicking guy right now. But in the future, that can obviously be his bread and butter. He's just continuing to try to stay healthy and continue to work on his field goal kicking to become more accurate. But the leg strength is there. accuracy is what will be his best friend in the long haul. Yeah. And his outlook could certainly become a field goal kicker when it's all said and done.
And he's an athlete. You can tell that from the way he made the tackle against USC. Real quick before we let you go, you think the Tigers take care of their business against Florida, Vanderbilt, and Oklahoma to close it out?
I think you have to. I think there's no other option than to do that. Brian Kelly knows that this team has to win out in order to have any type of opportunities in the foreseeable future. I think Blake Baker can dial up a scheme for Florida. You're going against a quarterback that's not 100% in DJ Lagway. He'll suit up more than likely, and he's trending in the right direction, just like Billy Napier said. But regardless, he will not be a guy who's playing at 100%. I think LSU can utilize that to their advantage. Garrett Nussmeier and company can try to diversify the playbook and get the running game going, but I think he'll be a little bit smarter with the football. For me, I'm riding with LSU and a nail-biter, of course, in the Swamp. It's a challenge to go on the road in the SEC and get a victory, but I think they can do that, bounce back. Just can't envision this team losing three straight games under Brian Kelly, so I think they get the job done in the Swamp.
Real quick, talk about Clemson, if you will, and Dabo Swinney and his approach towards the transfer portal and how that's worked out.
Yeah, it's unique, man. He's not a guy who likes to utilize it to his advantage for better or for worse, and he's going to have to adapt to the new norms of college football sooner rather than later. The transfer portal is the way to go when you need that immediate impact guy just instantaneously, right? So he's going to have to adapt sooner rather than later. And it's a unique approach, not utilizing it right now, but he's going to in the future. He's going to have to, or else that Clemson program will be in shambles. So it's, like you said, a unique approach, but times are changing, and he's going to have to adapt to the new norm.
You can howl at that hurricane, but it's going to come. You can howl all you want. Real quick, going back to Bryce Underwood, any indication, anything we could look for of any indication that the whole commitment could be in trouble, or do you think this is a done deal? You hate to jinx anything, but...
Yeah, no, I think after a three-day visit to Baton Rouge last weekend, all signs would point in the right direction for him. He got in on Saturday afternoon, had the opportunity to meet with the staff, get to Tiger Stadium, take some photos with some LSU icons, go around the tailgates, et cetera, before making his way to the field where he was accompanied by number one running back in America, Harlan Berry, number one cornerback, DJ Pickett, and all the other commitments that are committed in that 2025 class before going to a seat. Sunday, had a dinner with Brian Kelly and the rest of the staff that went positive from what I've heard. So all signs point towards him putting pen to paper with LSU. It's just a matter of time for him, right? You're going to see the Michigan buzz continue to swirl as we inch closer and closer to that early signing period. They're going to make their push. They've already offered millions of dollars, those reported NIL packages. But on the LSU side, they feel confidence. Their confidence has not wavered. And ultimately, the goal is for him to put pen to paper in December with LSU. Recruiting game's fluid. Anything can happen, but they're confident. I'm confident. I feel good about where LSU sits with Bryce Underwood.
And NIL ain't going to get you a Heisman. Real quick, if you had to pick me two teams right now play for the national championship, who are they going to be?
Whew.
I'm not holding you to it. This is at this point. It's a very fluid situation.
Yeah. I like where Texas is sitting at right now. I think that's a really good program. I think they've got their head on straight right now in the SEC. And then potentially maybe like an Ohio State or Oregon. I'd probably say Oregon and Texas. We'll throw Ohio State down the drain. For me, it's going to be Oregon and Texas if I had to pick two right now.
All right, thank you. I appreciate your time as always, Zach. And your work, Zach Nagy, publisher of LSU Tigers on Sports Illustrated. We'll take a break, come back, talk to the Cajun Cannon. Always fun to talk to Bobby Hebert. Got a lot of hot takes on a lot of different things. Very educated guy. We'll talk about the Saints and their resurrection, as I'm calling it right now, 9:35. It is currently 9:43, 17 till 10. Today would be your final day to register to win tickets to the next Saints home game against the Browns and Jameis Winston, the gift that keeps on giving. Sunday in the Caesars Superdome, you can score two premium tickets to the game plus a pair of VIP tailgate passes from Bullseye Event Group. Open bar with premium liquor. Did I skip two premium tickets to the game? I don't think so. All-you-can-eat buffet from celebrity chef Aaron May, all overlooking Champion Square. Winning's easy. Go to WWL.com/contest. Enter for your chance to win tickets as the Saints take on Cleveland. That's from Dudley DeBosier, official injury lawyer of the Saints and Saints Radio, WWL. You get until 5:59 to get that done. And as we talk about Bryce Underwood, a story pops up from TheWolverine.com. That apparently they're offering $10 million been offered to him to go to Michigan. And with that, we welcome in, yes, Tim, Bobby Hebert, Cajun Cannon, quarterback for the, you know, Bobby Hebert. How you doing, Bobby?
Good. How you doing, Tommy?
All right, let me say
so
this.
$10 million, $10 million?
Yeah. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, I'm not saying this to be a fan or to kiss anybody's rear end because I don't have to. But if y'all do not turn down the sound and listen to Deuce McAllister and Mike Haas call the game and Jeff Nowak on the sideline and then stay tuned for the point after, you're missing out on the whole story of the Saints. I'm just telling you that, and I mean that, Bobby, because I listen every Sunday and y'all do a great job. Now, that being said, you played NFL football. You had two sons that played college football. You're Bryce Underwood's dad. $10 million, solid concrete offer to play for Michigan, name, image, and likeness. What are you telling him?
Well, and I think, isn't he from Michigan?
He is from Michigan, yeah.
Stay home. I'm telling him, stay home. $10 million just coming out of high school? No, he won the lottery.
Because you don't know. I guess that's guaranteed, right? You don't know if he gets hurt. And look, I want him to come to LSU, but he could tear up a knee or anything else. You don't know any of this, right, if you're his dad?
Exactly. It's it's guaranteed as long as he don't quit. You know, if he'd get injured, he still would get it. If he'd play, and, you know, if he was disgruntled and he wasn't playing, he wanted to transfer, I'm sure he's going to have some kind of contract. But, that's unbelievable. That's why you're going to have some kind of legislation where they're going to end up having, like, a salary cap or something in college football. But that's going to have to be negotiated. So then you have to be a school employee. That's what it's all coming down to. So things will be collectively bargained. And they'll end up having like a commissioner, czar, like they do with Roger Goodell. They'll have that in college. Well, that's what is coming. And it might be within a handful of years. I don't think it's going to be like a decade from now. But, yeah, that's on. And, Tom, I just think in 1990 I didn't have a contract. And I now, you know, you have to look at inflation and everything. But in 1990, I didn't have a contract, so I looked at my market value where I was ranked amongst NFL quarterbacks. And I remember I wanted right under like $1.28 million. And so basically I held out that year for $1 million. And Fink said, well, no, we own you. I'm going to pay you what I want to pay you because they didn't have free agency then. And so it was basically I'll give you like $800,000 or something. And it was just a principle. I don't have a contract. I'm a capitalist. So it was unbelievable. I look at where we at now compared to where we were then. You know, you're looking at basically 30 years, but boy, have times changed.
That's $10 million over 4 years, to be clear, but still.
Okay.
Man, that's.
Yeah. No, still that's guaranteed. But talk about you always want your kid or yourself to get off to a great start in life. And what do you go to college for? To get a great education so you can get a better job.
Yeah, you got two and a half
opportunities.
Right, you got $2.5 million right here, guaranteed, right, for the first year at least. Or take a shot. I don't know. Let's hope it works out. Let's talk about the Saints.
Right. Okay.
You've been there, done that. You got the skins on a wall, to quote your nemesis, Jim Finks. Did you guys wind up being friends or not, you and Jim Finks?
Yeah, well, I was always friends with him. I always called him Mr. Finks out of respect. But it was crazy. Him and I got put in the Louisiana Hall of Fame at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, he was already dead. He had died, you know, cancer in the mid-90s. And, we're at the Hall of Fame thing in Natchitoches, and his son accepted the award. And his son was on my side, his own son. Mm-hmm. So he knew dealing with his dad how it was.
There you go.
and he was representing his dad. And no, so I'm just going to leave it at that. Him and I had some conversations. So, no, his dad was just, pardon my French, but a hard-ass old school. And it's just my way or the highway. Well, today, him being a general manager would drive him crazy. What they pay in the players. But no, I always respected him because I always respected my elders.
Let's talk about the Saints in a locker room. Have you been through it with an interim coach?
Yeah, Wade Phillips, Bum's son.
What happens in a week? What happens in a week? How can it turn around? What's going through your mind as a player when, you know, you find out, and I guess it's not a surprise, you know, the old guy's on the way out, then you find out they made the change, and you got the, what do you call him? You got the interim coach.
What's going through your mind? Well, what has to go through your mind, are you mature enough to handle it? And you have to be a pro.
the bottom line, okay, no excuse because, oh, well, we don't have the right coach and all that. No, you better look in the mirror, and if you want to keep that NFL lifestyle, you better get something done. So the way I always looked at it, and a number of players, now I'm being evaluated, you know, you can't, you know, it's like, you know, you can't fire all the players and keep the coach. You know, it's one thing. The players really aren't going nowhere in the short term. Now, long term, if you don't put good film out there and they're going to go in a different direction, get someone else. So I think just from that, getting the attention and having a little, you know, spark or juice, you know, that's how they describe it and these days. Young kids, you know, you got to have them. We need some juice. Well, that juice in Coach Rizzi, and I think he's a lot more emotional, but you need much more in emotion. It has to be a skill set. I can tell you right now, that's not good. If we do this, continue to do this. If you can't stop the run, and the way we're running the ball right now, I'm not consistent enough. Now, that's going to help having Eric McCoy, our main offensive lineman, our best offensive line coming back. And that the emotions can only take you so far. So, yeah, you just have to be a pro. And what happened last week, that's all fine and dandy. You beat Atlanta, and there's no – you have a favorable schedule. There's no way when you're playing pros, there's no way you shouldn't beat Cleveland. Cleveland's coming here. They're struggling. They got a couple of wins. You know Jameis Winston's tendencies? I'd be extremely disappointed if they lose to Cleveland Sunday. I'm not saying – Cleveland's probably saying, oh, we got to beat the Saints. But, no, it's not like we play in Detroit right now with the Ravens, where I would say, we'd be lucky to beat them. No, we should beat Cleveland. And Coach Rizzi knows that to get them motivated and headed in the right direction. But again, passion or, you know, emotion, that can only take you so far. Now you just got to go out there and execute.
You have passion. You have emotion. You love this Saints team. I know you do. And anybody that's ever sat next to you in a press box, they know that. You're a fan. Let's admit it, right? You're an ex-player. You love the Saints.
Well,
we
I
all
love football.
You. And you love football.
I'm a fan. I love football, and who are my local teams?
And I think that's great.
Saints and LSU.
The reason all that, Bobby, when you factor that in with the fact that you spent so many years with the team, how would you like to see this season play out? Ideally, where we are, it's hard to believe we're in a week 11 already with the weather. It's hard to believe because you think it's still summertime, but it's not. How would you like to see this season play out? Ideally, what would be best for the short-term, long-term interest of the fans, team, everybody?
Well, I like Coach Rizzi. I don't know. I like them. Now, they probably have to go like 7-1. For him to win and not only be the interim coach, but the head coach, some fans might not want that. They might want more an offensive-minded coach. But I can tell you, just because you special teams, your background, it's about leading men and having the right coaching staff, pushing the right button. One of the best coaches in the NFL right now is a special teams background, John Harbaugh, with the Baltimore Ravens. I think he's done a pretty good job. One of the greatest coaches in NFL history, Marv Levy, back when I was playing with the Buffalo Bills and Jim Kelly and all, he took the Bills to four straight Super Bowls. Now, they didn't win, but he still got them there. And people don't realize Bill Belichick, you know, you don't know offense, defense, everything, but he learned defense at a very high level. But he started out, he was a special teams coach. So you just, you know, I think right now they don't go with Coach Rizzi, they go more on the offensive side and get an offensive mind instead of a defensive coach, the way the game has changed. But you're going to have Coach Rizzi as the head coach, and Kubiak just has to get the offense going. What we got to do is draft better players. We need more great, elite young players. Right now, if you look on our roster, there's not too many teams that our young elite players that they would end up starting off on other teams. Like I think I said this before Eric McCoy, that he would start off for every NFL team, whether it was at center or guard. They either put him at left guard, right guard, or at center. But if you look at like Chris Olave, our best receiver, he's good, they're very good, but he's not elite. Mm-hmm. You know, he could start for a number of teams, like the number two receiver. And I look at Valdez Scantling. I mean, that's a big, fast receiver. Mm-hmm. Those kind of individuals now, while he's been on three different teams, because he gets to drops these sometimes.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that real quick before we run out of time. When it comes to him specifically with the dropsies, through your career and what you've seen, the guys you've played with, can a guy overcome that? Or once he shows you who he is that who he is?
No, not really. They can, because I can tell you, at the drops, he's in a Saints uniform, and you turn around, I guess, more concentration, more drills, working extra. Deborah Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
Deborah Henderson with the Saints had the drops. Then all of a sudden, he's playing with Sean Payton and Drew Brees, and he turned into a pretty good damn receiver and a good deep threat and a lot of stretch. So, yeah, you can build upon that. And he knows he, to mature as a receiver, you can be as fast as the wind, but you got to catch the ball. So all I know is he looked explosive in those two catches against Atlanta, and I think he'll build upon that.
Thank you for your time, my friend. We love you. We love having you here. And I'm not trying to be sentimental here or anything, but just as there was a time when we knew there was going to be no Drew Brees playing quarterback, there's going to be a time where Bobby Hebert is not going to be on WWL, only because he chooses to retire and do something else. I'm not saying it's
Tom, I got 6 grandkids. I'm probably going to end up having about 7 or 8. So
It's not imminent or anything. I'm saying is enjoy him while he's here. That's all I'm saying, right?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Tom.
I'll be listening to you on Sunday, my friend. Thank you. 9:55, taking a break. Coming back on WWL.